All kinds of comedy, stand-up, sketch, songs, even poetry, and the occasional interview. Mondays at 10:30 a.m. Tune in or listen to Absolutely Frivolous on our archives page on cfrc.ca.
St. Monday watches over you and me and grants the bone exhausted some liberty.
G'day and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Nathika Shashakanth, who is doing a Master of Science in Rehabilitation Science under the supervision of Dr. Sandra Fuchile. Welcome to Grad Chat, Nathika.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And so, Nathika, I'm so glad you came on the show. And just for everyone knows, Nathika approached me after I was on a bit of a panel discussion for her program on knowledge translation. Which was awesome to be on. And I guess you were inspired to use this opportunity of Grad Chat to help you in your learning more. Is that why, or you'd already thought about doing it before the panel?
No, I was inspired to also do some knowledge translation, but I thought this would also help me for my thesis defense, which I'm going to do soon. So I'm like, why not start small and then like let the examiners do what they do.
Or start off with a very friendly environment, yes. A very friendly, safe space.
Yes, definitely.
And practice on me instead, yeah. Which is pretty awesome. And I did really enjoy that panel discussion with the two professors that you had there as well, because as we know, and you would have heard through that panel discussion, how important it is to learn how to talk about our work, isn't it? Because yeah. It's not always as simple as we think it is.
Yeah, definitely. Like, and also how to talk about our research and who we're talking to. So the audience is most important. The simpler you make it, the better it is, because if you're looking for a grant or if you're looking for a donation, then those people just need to know that, okay, this is going to work, and they don't need like a lot of the scientific terms and stuff, right, which they're not going to understand. And I don't know if they're going to like even be interested if you're talking in scientific terminology to them.
Well, exactly. We've got to keep it to, you know, what would interest us.
Yes,
and so
yeah.
do your family understand what you're doing?
My mom does. I don't think my dad kind of does.
Good one, Dad.
Yes.
we'll get him sorted.
Yes.
We'll just get him to listen to the show.
Yes.
So do you think, what is your background was it always leaning towards rehabilitation science, that kind of area?
Yes, it was. So I'm an internationally educated physiotherapist, okay, from India, and I'm currently working towards my physiotherapy license here in Canada as well.
Oh, that's good.
Yes, so it's always towards rehabilitation.
Right, and so you're wanting to use your research that you're doing to help when you get back into the practical, the
yes,
clinical side of things?
Yes, and also the things I saw when I was doing my previous clinical research, so that kind of inspired to do the research as well. So, yeah, I think it's a bit of both, the past and for the future purpose.
Yeah, and I find that's what's interesting about the rehabilitation science student. I mean, some do come directly from undergrad, but most have already been in the field of somewhere within the health field, mm-hmm, and have seen things happen.
Yes.
Out in the field, and then they go, you know what, I want to learn a bit more about that. You know, is there a process we can make better? Is there a way of rehabilitation that we can do in a differently, mm-hmm, to get better outcomes and things like that? So, and I don't think you can really do that if you come straight from undergrad, not in all the areas anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's always, I always find it fascinating listening to the rehab science students of their backgrounds, you know, because we've had people in architecture who are architects. You know, like, I don't know if you ever met Navjeet.
Yes, I have. Yes, he's my senior, and I'm very proud to, like, you know, have met him, and he's inspired me to, like, get out my research and, yeah, to talk more about what I'm currently doing.
Oh, that's
And
great.
Also to be proud of my entire journey.
Yeah.
In, like, grad school, because I know grad school can be very tough and it's a long process.
It is a long process, even though, you know, the master's is only a couple of
couple
years.
Couple of years, yes.
You pack a hell of a lot in those
oh,
two
yes,
years.
Oh, yes, we do.
Okay, so I guess we should get onto your research topic, because that's what it's about, and let's give you some help towards your defense that's coming up.
Yes, thank you.
Which is awesome. And your title is The Effect of the Parent-Administered Sensory Motor Intervention, or PASI, on the Developmental Outcomes in Infants Born Preterm at 18 Months of Age. So before we get into these questions, tell us a little bit about this. What, you know, what is the overview? What is this topic about?
Yeah, so the inspiration came from when I was working with a lot of pediatric age groups in the rehabilitation. And it was mostly parents who would come in, like, at least in my home country, that mm-hmm. they weren't understanding of what's particularly happening with their child, but they did want to support their child and be with them during their rehabilitation process. And they were very dedicated. Some of them even, like, moved their hometowns just because they didn't have a rehabilitation center in their particular hometown. So, yeah, I was just thinking that if parents, whenever a baby is born preterm and they're educated about what's going on with their baby and they're involved in the whole medical process, then it would just, like, be easier for them to take care of their child mm-hmm. as the child grows older.
Well, I think even just from that, you've stated something there that you can easily transfer that to what's happening in Canada. I mean, not everyone has easy access to some of these health supports, whether you're in India or whether you're in Canada. And so it's actually quite a natural research area that you can do it here.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking about what happened back home, and then maybe some of the things you work out from here, you can send back home too. Let's do that. Anyway, we can get on to that. So you mentioned this is for preterm babies, basically those babies who are born less than 34 weeks. Is that correct? Is that how you...
37, but then our cohort of the babies were less than 34 weeks.
Okay. So you mentioned that. So what are the possible, just from that, without anything else, what are possible developmental complications or delays for these preterm babies, if any? I mean, what are you seeing? Why are you wanting to study them?
Yeah, so there are five main delays or domains that we say, mm-hmm. and those are social, cognitive, gross motor, fine motor, and language skills.
Okay.
So that would, like, if they have it in two or more of these domains or areas, then we'd say they have a global developmental delay. Or if it's in one particular area, then it's a specific skill delay.
Okay.
And preterm babies usually tend to have a delay. Like, previous research has shown that these babies who are born preterm have the developmental delays later on.
At least one of them. But how long does it take to determine which of the delays that they've had? Because you're looking at babies who are 18 months old.
Yes.
So when would a doctor or when would a parent have a thought that maybe there's something not working quite right for my kid? You know, I've had other kids before mm-hmm. and by this stage they should be doing this developmentally or having more eye contact or, you know, all those sorts of different things, or they don't seem to be touching anything or hearing anything. So when do the practitioners or parents figure out, maybe I need to check this out? Because I'm sure it would be before 18 months.
Yes, it's definitely before 18 months. So the hospitals have, like, an inventory where they probably would document the babies who are born preterm that would be less than 37 weeks old. And in Canada, specifically at the Kingston Health Sciences Center, I do know that they have a neonatal follow-up clinic.
Okay.
Yeah, so they would have a follow-up. But again, because of the limited access to the healthcare, there are delays in getting that follow-up date, or the availability is low. And then it kind of, you know, delays the tracking of if mm-hmm. the child has a developmental delay or not.
So if I've understood correctly, are you saying right now in Canada, in Kingston?
Yes, yes.
Some babies who were born preterm aren't necessarily getting into the system quickly enough.
Yes, yes. There's a waiting list for them to get into the system.
Oh, that's
after discharge. So until they're in the hospital and then they're being taken care of, it's fine. But after discharge, to get into the follow-up clinic and to get their availability dates and to undergo the screening, it takes some time.
Oh, that's a bit sad.
Yeah.
And can it only be done at the Kingston Health Centre, or there are other areas
there
nearby,
are other areas
like in Belleville or Brockville, which are, I mean, you still have to get a car to get there. But
yes, yes. Yeah, the transportation is equally hard, but there are other centres across Canada. But again, for the parents to go reach there, it's tough for them. And also since they're working and they may have other kids and financial issues. So
right,
there's
right.
a lot of other aspects to consider for them to get into the availability and to the clinics.
Oh, I didn't realize that was happening. So I've learned something today. I'm not sure I want to learn that, actually, because it's not good for our health system.
No,
if we can't do that. That's good to know. And I didn't realize that was a problem here in Kingston. So is there a particular order, if they are able to get into one of these programs, is there a particular order that they can find out what one of those five domains that may be at issue that you talked about?
So I guess it would involve like a whole healthcare team, and they would do like a list of assessments that they have using outcome measures. And then it's usually a doctor who identifies that they have the developmental delay and that they've been born preterm because of that. And mm-hmm. then they'd come into rehab to us with the note that they're developmentally delayed in that particular,
area. Okay. So let's talk about then this parent-administered sensory motor intervention program. If you can explain what that is and why was this program started? And is this something just in Canada, or is this in other places too? Or is it just here in Kingston?
Well, the parent-administered sensory motor intervention particularly was started by my supervisor,
awesome.
Dr. Sandra Fucile. So it's her program, and she's done most of the originating, and when I was thinking of my inspiration and my idea, I kind of connected with her.
Fantastic.
But there are other programs like that, who have been doing the parent-administered and the family integrated care programs in Canada. So yes, but then this is specifically involving the parents into the team and letting them provide an intervention.
Which makes sense from your earlier comment.
Yes,
when
yes,
you
yes.
said not everyone can come or get into the clinic.
Yes,
so
yes.
let's teach people how
people,
to do
yes.
it at home.
Especially the parents, since they're going to be with their kid most of the time.
And so is one of the purposes, obviously the first purpose is to give people more access to helping.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess the other part then is if more parents can do it themselves, that frees up the clinics for those that are more acute.
Yes.
To sort of make everyone have some sort of programming?
Kind of, but it's also that the parents kind of learn to identify their child's behavioral cues. And whenever something is wrong, the parent is more easily able to identify it.
Right.
And also that it creates a more infant and parent bonding.
Which is always important.
Yes, because there's also a bit of a separation anxiety when the kid is left alone in the NICU. So any preterm child who's born would have to be in the NICU for a while.
Right.
And then they're just left alone with random people, loud noises and constant blood tests and different people coming in from the healthcare team. So it's a lot for a baby to take in, and also for the parent who's just sitting outside and doesn't know what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good point then. So when should this kind of program start? Are you saying that the parents need to be taught some, if they know their kid's going to be preterm, we don't always know those things, right? If we know the kid's going to be preterm, does it mean that we can teach these parents this program so that when the kid is born, can they be sitting in the NICU, or they still can't be sitting in the NICU?
No, this is after the kid is born. So
yes.
After the kid is born, and that's before 37 weeks of mm-hmm. gestation, that's when the parents are thought the massage, and we gave a little bit of oral stimulation to the babies.
Okay.
The parents gave it, and the parents were thought about that. And so then they were allowed to go into it, and it was done by a previous research assistant and my supervisor. Mm-hmm. And I'm currently doing the 18-month follow-up. So the kids are 18 months old right now.
Right.
And I called the parents and then I asked them, oh, how do you think your kid is doing right now? And then I used two outcome measures to kind of check how
their development. And this is all, and your checkup is to see how well this program is working.
Yeah.
But the program itself, like teaching the parents.
Yes, yes.
When do they start to learn about this program and how to do it for their child?
I don't think I can particularly comment on that because I wasn't involved in the original program. It was done by another research assistant and my supervisor.
Okay.
But mine is just towards looking into like what the parents think about their child's development right now.
Okay.
And how they think their child is doing.
From the program.
Yes, and also how they're doing. Yeah.
Okay. So tell us a bit more about that, because clearly if this is a program here in Kingston, there's a certain number of families that you've got on your books.
Yes.
With kids who were preterm. And now that you're looking at them 18 months later.
Later, yeah.
What kind of things do you ask these parents? Well, first of all, they've given permission to be part of this follow-up study.
Yes, yes.
But how do you approach the parents to ask them about, you know, how's your kid doing? Are you looking for, as you mentioned before, it's important that bonding with the child. Is it to do with that? Or are you finding that, I don't know, what are you looking for in those follow-ups?
So we have a list of participants from the initial study.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just, so 80 people were part of the initial study.
And the initial study was what? So
the PASI,
they
yes.
haven't gone through. Oh, it was the PASI.
Yes, the initial study was the PASI. And then now I'm looking at the long-term effect of the PASI. So at 18 months. So now I just called all of those parents from the initial study. And after calling them, I think 51 people, like the parents responded.
Okay.
And then we had a predetermined script that we were going to like talk to them about, because mm-hmm. also it was done by another research assistant. So she kind of did half of the parents. Mm-hmm. And then I had to look up as to like how many people she'd called. And then I called the remaining parents.
Right.
Yeah. So I called the remaining parents and like I had to let them know that I think the previous research assistant was also part of the initial program.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to inform them because they were more familiar with her because they'd seen her in person, whereas they didn't know me and they hadn't seen me in person.
Yes.
So it was kind of harder to connect with them. But then I think it was better when I told like the previous person's name and then that like, you know, they had worked with her and they were part of this study mm-hmm. and if they remembered. And also I had to take a verbal consent again, asking them whether they were okay to like participate again and if they had the time to answer those two questionnaires, because it would take a considerable amount of their time.
So what kind of questions are you asking them?
So
is that okay to ask?
yes, that's okay. So we used two questionnaires or outcome measures, which is called the Infant Development Inventory and the Pediatric Quality of Life.
And are they standard sort of questionnaires?
Yes, they are.
Any baby and any pediatrician follows. Okay.
Yes, yes. There are different questionnaires, but we decided to use these questionnaires. Mm-hmm. So the infant development questionnaire would look at the different areas of the baby and like their physical functioning, their psychosocial skills, and then their emotional stuff that we look into. So there's a preformed set of questions and I just ask them like, I'm going to ask you this area right now, and then I'm going to slowly read through like one of the first questions.
Right.
Like, for example, I just say, do you think your baby is eating properly? And then on a scale of 1 to 5, I'd be like, yes, I agree. And sometimes they have an issue. Sometimes like I strongly agree, strongly disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would just answer as to what they think or what they've observed as far as they can remember.
Right. Can I go back one step?
Yes.
I'm just trying to clarify in my head. So you're doing this check at 18 months and you said your colleague, the previous person did it before the original one. What age were the kids then on the original assessment? Because you're comparing, right?
Yes. So the initial one, they were like before the discharge.
So they were still in the hospital.
That was in the hospital.
Okay.
And then there was also a 4-month follow-up.
Okay.
And then this is the 18 months.
And this is the 18.
So it's kind of like a longitudinal study where like you have certain checkpoints and then at each checkpoint, you just check the baby and with the parents. Initially, if they were at the hospital, you check the baby as well. But then since they're not, and it's easier to call the parents because they're also busy.
Yes.
And it's not good to like keep calling them in and then it's a lot for them to come in and
So with that then, so you're doing before they leave hospital, 4 months and 18 months. And you're looking at those results against the standard
the
standard checklist. So 4 months to 18 months, that's a long break.
Yes.
In my opinion, for a child, because the child is developing, well, we hope, quickly.
Yes, yes.
Not always the case. So I'm wondering what was the reason for waiting to 18 months as opposed to, say, 12 months?
There was supposed to be a 12 months, but I think there was a gap in between the previous research assistant and then now. So there was like,
All right. Because I'd be interested to see, you know, even though I know it takes time to see the increments. So with that then, from what you've found so far or asked and the answers that you've given, are these children, these preterms, after using the PASI program, the parents using the PASI program, are these children on par with what the standards are saying?
Well, our results were not significantly seen, but then the only main thing which we saw, which was a really good result, was the parents who were part of the PASI program, they had lesser concerns with regards to their child when compared to the parents who were not part of the PASI program.
Okay. See, that's interesting, right?
Yes.
So we're all looking at, you know, what happens with the development of the kid.
Yes. We don't see the parental aspect of
it. But then it's the parent side, which actually is much more important to a point, I think, of understanding how they feel. And they're not as, perhaps not as anxious as saying, well, my kid's not keeping up, that my kid should be at this percentile by now, etc.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting positive side that you've seen. Do you think, so can I just ask another thing about the PASI program itself? How long does the parent do this PASI program? To what extent? Is it just while they're in the NICU, that in hospital, that they're doing the PASI program, the massage and things that you were talking about? Or do they carry on some of this when they're out of the hospital? When do they actually stop doing this?
It's just until they're in the hospital.
So just while they're in the hospital. And then after, so just those few weeks in the hospital can have quite a big impact.
Yes.
Well, that's amazing. That's really good. And I think it's nice that the parents, particularly when they're probably anxious with a kid being in the NICU, to, as you said, have a better, more contact with their kid and a better understanding of how they're helping, not just saying, I hope the doctors and nurses are doing what they're meant to.
Yes.
So who does the training of the parents in this program? Is it the nurses? Is it you guys? Who teaches them about the PASI program?
It was the previous research assistant who taught them about the PASI program, and they were also given a booklet.
Okay.
With like regards to visual representations and stuff. So they did both, and then they kind of went in and gave the treatment. So, but again, I think I don't have too much of information on that because I wasn't part of that.
Yeah, which is a shame, actually.
I know. I would have loved to have been a part of it, too.
Well, as a physio, too. I mean, the thing is, you would, whether it's that your predecessor or whether it's the nurses and things showing the parent how to do it. Because you do have to be careful with these babies when they're in the NICU. I mean, you can't be applying a lot of pressure.
Yes.
But I think the main thing is, as long as they're getting some sort of stimulation sometimes is enough, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're looking at. Okay. Let's see. This is fascinating. So with this research, what are you hoping to achieve from the research that you're doing here? I mean, clearly it sounds like, and I know it's not finished, that it is helping the parents and the child. But what else are you hoping to achieve? Because this is a smaller program. It's not like it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
What are you hoping to achieve?
Well, I'm hoping to achieve that, you know, you look more at the parents' side while like the hospitals are incorporating treatments to any of their children, not just preterm children. children, mm-hmm. but overall. And then that hospitals also incorporate into like the family integrated care. Because right. I know other parts of Canada and other places do have it. But then I wish it would be more incorporated and more emphasized on mm-hmm. so that they feel involved.
So and I guess you're, from what you're saying there too, is with when there's ways that we can get us as adults involved with helping the child in the hospitals, which are terribly understaffed.
Yes, yes.
That's a way of us all helping each other out.
Yes.
Do you think a program like this would be beneficial to parents in India?
Yes, I'm sure.
And do you think it would be possible to put it over there?
Yes, yes, it would, given the fact that they want to put so much of interest and time into their children, mm-hmm. and they genuinely want their child to get better. And even if that means like moving from one city to another city and like completely changing their lifestyle,
right?
I think it would definitely be helpful back home. Because I also feel like in India, I noticed that physiotherapy isn't a regulated or organized like a profession like it is in Canada.
Okay, right.
So it also makes it a little bit more harder for us to implement policy changes or even have like a standard grade of salary and mm-hmm. pay. So it's kind of a little bit different over there, but I'm hoping that it would improve in a few years at least.
I was thinking, as you were talking, there's some societies where the family bond is super, super important.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as the world has got faster and we're wanting more to be able to do more things, etc., you know, that family unit isn't as strong, in my opinion, as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think having programs like this will, in a way, try and bring families back to see, you know, I haven't just got a kid, you know, we need to help, we need to look after each other. Do you think it's also a way of, whether it's here in Canada or back in India, that will help that family unit get even closer?
Yes, yes, I'm pretty sure. And I also feel like after looking at the studies and the research that I've, literature that I've been mm-hmm. through, I also feel it's very important to include the father into the study.
Right.
Because it's mostly the mothers who are like more with the maternal caretaking instinct and stuff, and the fathers usually have to end up providing for the study. That's what at least they've seen in India and
right.
with the other studies across. But I feel it's also very important because the father feels to like, you know, tends to feel left out
mm-hmm.
and doesn't know what's happening, whereas he's probably just providing financial support and often tends to develop a little bit more of anxiety and like doesn't know what's happening to their child, but
right.
still wants to be a part of the thing. So I feel it's very important to make sure that both the parents do it.
Did you, so maybe this is a, whether this is asked in one of your follow-up sessions, do you ask each of the parents individually, what did they get out of it?
No, because it's usually whoever picks up the phone. And
oh.
So I don't know. And mostly I've seen whoever picks up the phone is the mom. And I've barely been able to talk to their fathers.
Right.
So whichever phone number is given is their mom's phone number.
For the next group?
Yes.
Tell them, yeah, I want to speak to the father too. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Because it'd be interesting to see their opinion on how they're
yes.
thinking the child is developing. And,
yes.
And then also, as you said, what did they get from it?
From, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one. See, fantastic. Nathika, thank you so much. We've come to an end, unfortunately, but thank you so much for coming on and explaining to us about the PASI program. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
And I think clearly those that have been involved have got something from it, which is always
yes.
a good result, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So good luck with that. Good luck with your defense. I know
thank
you're
you.
Going to be absolutely fine.
Thank you.
With summer and things coming on, enjoy the summer coming up.
Yes, I'm looking forward to the good weather.
Aren't we all?
Yes.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Grad Chat. Grad Chat.
Mondays can be a tough day. But would you like something to brighten up your Monday afternoon? Well, tune in to my show, Dark Glasses, on CFRC 101.9. My name's Daniel Wolf, and the show is now in its 14th year with a mixture of mainly jazz, but also blues, folk, some pop, even retro pop, and the occasional interview. So that's Dark Glasses, Mondays at 2 p.m.
Vai marinheiro, vai, vai, vai buscar a Laurindinha. Vai marinheiro, vai, vai, ela é tua, não é minha. Sim, nosso é, com toda a certeza, o programa Atlantis, que transmitimos dos estúdios da CFRC, no quadrante 101.9 FM, em sistema de cabo 90.9, aos domingos das 18 às 20 horas, com locução de Eduardo Pereira.
Vai marinheiro, vai, vai.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
From the Wings Archive 2016, a maternity hospital in Israel trying to be a bridge for peace. Today on Wings.
Demographic danger. They really use this term, demographic danger, meaning these women will give birth to many kids. These many kids are going to be, how surprising, Palestinian kids. They give birth to the next terrorist.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hadassah is an international women's Zionist organization started in 1912. In 1913, it sent two maternity nurses to Palestine. Its founder, Henrietta Zold, advocated in the 1940s for Arab-Jewish reconciliation in the form of two states collaborating in an economic union. That failed, but Hadassah's first project grew into a range of medical facilities open to all. The pressures around that policy were investigated by Shana Sheely for this documentary. Originally aired in the series Making Contact, it is co-hosted by Monica Lopez.
It's amazing to see her in your arms after 9 months. I felt so happy, really.
Shema just gave birth to a girl. She went into labor hours after her brother was shot in both legs by Israeli forces.
It's my first baby. So I'm really interested to have a good treatment. I was afraid.
Afraid to go to an Israeli hospital. She delivered at a Palestinian one, even though she thinks Israeli hospitals have the highest standards of healthcare.
I'm afraid if I go there that they may do something for me or my daughter. And maybe not now I can see it, maybe more after 5, 6, 10 years. And I'm not ready for that.
In Shema's mind, the Israeli hospital would harm her daughter. That would never happen, says Drori Hochner, head of OBGYN of an Israeli hospital less than 2 kilometers away from where Shema gave birth. It goes against all possible principles of care and this hospital's reputation as an island of healing. It's called Hadassah Hospital at Mount Scopus. The hospital was built in the 1930s on a hilltop in a mostly Arab area.
In 1939, the doors opened. Everybody came. The pioneer Jews from the kibbutzim, the religious Jews from the old city, Arabs, all were welcome. The hospital was meant to be an island of healing for Arab and Jew alike. And here in East Jerusalem, it would be available to all.
Just a few years ago, the hospital was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for exactly that.
Inside Hadassah University Mount Scopus Hospital, it's not unusual to see yarmulke-wearing Jews sitting or strolling alongside hijab-wearing Muslims.
There are a lot of stories about unity inside the hospital. The clip you're hearing is from Reuters, produced in November 2015.
And we truly believe that medicine is a bridge to peace.
And that bridge, she hopes, will one day extend beyond the hospital halls.
This is not exactly one of those stories, though. It takes place inside the hospital walls, in the sixth-floor maternity ward where rooms facing east look out over Jerusalem's iconic Golden Dome and Old Walled City. We'll hear from Israeli and Palestinian women who are avoiding the maternity ward because they don't feel safe being so close to women from the other side. We'll hear from nurse midwives at Mount Scopus about the moments when bringing new Israeli and Palestinian life into the world is complicated. And from a rabbi who was called to the hospital to mediate tension among maternity ward staff during a time when the sacred space of healing couldn't withstand divisiveness from the conflict outside. Because even here in the maternity ward, a place dedicated to unity, healing, and literally bringing new life into the world, maintaining that bridge to peace isn't always easy.
We are people. We hear the radio, we're influenced, and I think we come to work also with our personal package.
That's Dorit Hochner. She's the head of OBGYN for the hospital. She's an Israeli Jew. She calls herself a leftist.
You know, you can't just ignore everything that happens out of the hospital.
Especially now. From October 2015 to May 2016, Palestinians killed over 30 Israelis, and Israelis killed more than 200 Palestinians, many described by Israeli authorities as attackers. People are scared. So scared that pregnant women from both sides of the conflict are avoiding the maternity ward when the violence was at a peak.
I was scared, you know, there's Arabs there. Like whenever they decide, they just take out a knife or whatever they want.
Malki is an ultra-Orthodox Jew. She delivered her first two kids at Mount Scopus, but went to a hospital in Jewish West Jerusalem for her third. Even though the Mount Scopus staff tried to make her comfortable.
So when they share a room, they don't put you together with an Arab. They try not to.
That separation isn't enough to make her feel safe.
In the hallway, and when you go to eat, they come a lot. It's scary. I'm scared to go there.
There's no safety. There's no trust also.
Hadil is scared too. She's a Palestinian from East Jerusalem, and she also delivered her first two kids at Mount Scopus. This time, Hadil felt she had to choose between the best healthcare at an Israeli hospital and personal safety at a Palestinian one.
It was really, really hard decision. Really.
She chose Palestinian.
Now it's very special time that it all rooms is full because in the last time, because of this security conditions, people don't want to come to this hospital because the Jewish afraid from Arabic people and Arabic people afraid from Jewish people.
Rivka is a nurse midwife at Mount Scopus. Her name has been changed to protect her identity. She's Jewish. All the nurse midwives here are.
And I'm afraid also I'm going only by my car, not in the buses. I'm afraid of my kids go along outside. I want them to stay home all the time.
Home is in a West Bank settlement, about a 40-minute drive away. Violence there has been severe. A lot of the nurse midwives here are religious West Bank settlers. We are with Rivka now, on the night shift.
I want to come to drink coffee.
It's past midnight, and she's sipping a hot drink from a paper cup. Her lips are pink and glossy.
I feel celeb now.
She's wearing turquoise eyeshadow to match her green scrubs. There are about five other midwives around tonight. They'll all be getting new uniforms soon. Purple. Rivka was the leader behind this cause. You know those people whose work makes them happier than anything? Rivka's one of those.
It looks like a miracle. It's a baby come out. Wow. You just see the head between the legs of the lady. It's very special thing to see a lady before and after.
Some of Rivka's co-workers say she's one of the best midwives at Mount Scopus. Tonight, from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., Rivka's on duty in the admission room, but helps out a co-worker with three patients. One Israeli, two Palestinian. Being there to support all of them is really important to Rivka. So important that she signed up for Arabic lessons with a tutor in her settlement. She knows some words in Arabic related to her work, words like push, but not enough words to really talk. The Israeli Ministry of Health provides a 30-minute translation service over the phone that can be accessed by a toll-free number. Tonight, one of the Palestinian patients has a Hebrew-speaking husband in the room. Rivka talks to him. The hospital says that in 95% of the cases, someone's around and available to help with translation. Rivka says a bunch of the doctors and some other midwives speak Arabic. She relies on them or patients' family members who speak Hebrew when her patients don't. The sixth-floor janitor, a Palestinian from nearby, helps out a lot with translation. Tonight, Rivka smiles big and approaches the Palestinian patients with affection.
All the time I hope it will be make the people close. They will remember they were together and we helped them. But I must be nice with everybody because I'm a nurse. But I don't know what these people will do outside. Maybe they will kill us. I don't know.
Another nurse midwife who also lives in a settlement said she's never afraid of her patients. When an Arab woman is lying naked on a hospital bed, she said, everyone can see that there's not a knife on her. Now, it's important to remember that a midwife's responsibilities are different from a doctor's. The International Confederation of Midwives says a midwife's job is not just to provide treatment. It's to provide care, comfort, encouragement, to nurture a woman through the most intimate moment of her life with loving support, which isn't always easy. While all of the nurse midwives I spoke with, including Rivka, say the conflict outside the hospital does not get in the way of their professional responsibilities to laboring Palestinian women, many say it can make the job more difficult, especially in times of conflict when the us versus them thing is even more distinct. Like during the summer of 2014, when Israel was at war with Gaza.
The time of the war and this conflict in Gaza, it was more difficult for me to take care about our people. A lot of midwives have sons there, so they should come here and take care of the people who calls their babies jihad and pray that their sons will be okay and will be saved. It's very difficult.
Because this name said, we hate you, it's our country.
Another nurse midwife told me she worked a shift the day three dead Israeli boys were found after an alleged kidnapping by Palestinians. Her name is Avia. She delivered two Palestinians that day.
They were nice. It wasn't something with them. It was hard, like with this horrible thing that happened. You want something like, I brought a Jewish baby to the world.
You need something to calm yourself, she says. Something like bringing a Jewish baby into the world.
You go to the little boxes in your head, which aren't particularly true. It's like your safe place.
Avia recognizes how hard it can be to separate fear from logic. And Rivka struggles with that too.
You feel so strange. They attack us and I should stay with this woman.
Tonight, Rivka stays with them. She checks on her patients with a smile. She hugs them and coos at them. She takes a coffee break and then she goes back to check on them. They're not even her assigned patients. And then she thinks about it.
I think sometimes it's our hospital. It's our place. And I want to help them. I want to give the service. I want to be very humanic to them. But it's my hospital. So my people, it's first.
On Wings, you are listening to a documentary about maternity ward policies at Hadassah University Hospital in Israel. Originally aired in the series Making Contact, it is produced by Shana Sheely and co-hosted by Monica Lopez.
As far as Rivka is concerned, her people, Jewish people, come first in the maternity ward. The result of that is something she goes back and forth on.
I think it's the same treatment for everybody. It's no different.
Rivka insists she treats Palestinian women fairly. Except for one thing.
Sometimes I told you about the rooms. Only this, maybe. But the treatment, the level of treatment is the same.
The rooms are something I heard about a lot at Mount Scopus.
So we have beautiful rooms, big beautiful rooms, and smaller rooms. When Jewish people come, we prefer to give the beautiful rooms for Jewish people. And some midwives hate it, and I don't know what to do.
To be sure, there are a lot of midwives who appear to work totally professionally, who advocate for equitable care and the same rooms for Israeli and Palestinian patients. But most of the 8 women I spoke with who had been nurse midwives in the hospital said that Israeli women sometimes get preferential treatment, including the better rooms with the better views. A few months after I recorded the interviews you're hearing, Israeli journalist Dikla Aharon released a report saying Arab and Jewish women are routinely segregated in maternity wards across Israel. Aharon called 7 hospitals, including Mount Scopus, and asked about separation between Jews and non-Jews in maternity wards. Only 2 refuse to segregate patients.
Okay, is it a policy of the hospital?
Here she is, calling Mount Scopus. A nurse answers. She says something along the lines of, "Of course we separate Jews from non-Jews. We do it without requests from the patients. We're even strict about it." Segregation in maternity wards is not a new story in Israeli media. Reports about maternity ward segregation have been published in reputable papers like Haaretz since 2006. But this time, after a member of Israel's parliament spoke up in favor of maternity ward segregation, Aharon's report became a topic of national conversation. Israeli online developer Dori Adar created a satirical web game called Categorize the Maternity Ward. It's a wordplay on the Hebrew term for maternity triage. To win the game, players swipe Arab women's ID cards left into a dark, grungy hospital room on the screen. They swipe Jewish women's ID cards right into a bright, spacious hospital room. And Yonatan Blumenfield wrote and performed a parody song online based on responses from hospital spokespeople and far-right government officials. The chorus of the song roughly translates into, "Just not an Ethiopian midwife, that's gross. Just not an Arab midwife, and, if possible, just to make sure that in the bed next door, an Arab is not being born. Because a good Arab is an Arab not born." Segregation in maternity wards is forbidden by Israel's Ministry of Health. It is against the official policy of all hospitals. A spokesperson for the Israeli Ministry of Health told reporters that the national health insurance law ensures equal treatment for all patients. Dorit Hochner, the head of OBGYN at Mount Scopus, told reporters that Arab and Jewish patients get the same medical treatment. The reason the hospital separates some patients, she said, is because they request separation. She says the hospital tries to be considerate of everyone's requests. Still, some nurse midwives say a patient's request is not a reason to separate Jewish from non-Jewish patients. One of those midwives is Tammy Daron. Tammy told me a story that unfolded in the Mount Scopus maternity ward several years ago. She was taking her Palestinian patient into a delivery room when a religious nurse midwife blocked the door, refusing entry. It was this midwife's first day back to work after being with her son in the hospital, a soldier, badly wounded during an operation in Gaza.
"This room is only for Jewish women."
That's what the midwife said when Tammy tried to enter the room with her laboring patient.
I told her, "Look, there's no connection between this woman who came to give birth and what happened to your son."
Too many midwives at Mount Scopus, Tammy says, connect violence against Jews to all Palestinians. She eventually left the hospital because of that racism.
"Demographic danger. They really use this term,
demographic danger, meaning these women will give birth to many kids. These many kids are going to be, how surprising, Palestinian kids, not with us. They give birth to the next terrorist. And you can hear the nurses that take care of the babies, they also say, here's another terrorist born.
It's this dehumanization, she says, that allows unequal treatment, like the separate rooms.
I don't think that she says, now I will revenge. It's not that simple. She doesn't see this woman as a human being. She sees her some idea of enemy. You know, when a woman comes to you, she gets undressed, you see her naked. She's spread, actually, on the bed in front of you. She opens her legs and it's the most fragile position that can be. She gives you so much trust and take advantage of this confidence is the ugliest thing you can do, I think.
Again, a lot of midwives at Mount Scopus advocate for equitable care for Palestinian and Israeli women. And the hospital denies any difference in the treatment of Palestinian and Israeli patients. But the issue of blocking Palestinians from the bigger rooms caused so much tension among the midwives that the Hospital Ethics Committee called in Rabbi Benny Lau to talk about equal treatment.
I just read the first chapter of the second book in the Bible, Exodus, about the midwives in Egypt.
Those Egyptian midwives were commanded by Pharaoh to kill all the Jewish baby boys.
And then I played with that. You know, I tried to say what kind of hospital they have in the river of the Nile.
He said that the Egyptian will get the most beautiful, spacious rooms with a view to the Nile. And the Hebrew women will get tiny rooms with no windows.
Rabbi Lau's talk took place in a normal staff room. But Tammy remembers the meeting was not normal at all. The room was packed with what seemed to be over 30 people. Midwives, doctors, senior staff. It was tense. The midwives sat in two groups on opposite sides of the room, for and against. For giving Palestinian women the good rooms and against it.
It was very emotional, very emotional, and very tense. And I think the people who were not from our staff were shocked by the level of emotions. I don't think that in any other section in the hospital there are such levels of emotions towards this issue of, you know, demographic danger.
The meeting ended in people shouting at each other about what the Bible says. Rabbi Benny Lau said the Bible commands Jews to remember that they were once slaves in Egypt, so now they should treat the minorities of their land with kindness. In response, the midwives against giving Palestinian women the bigger rooms cited the commandment that says Jews should take care of the people of their own city before taking care of others. One of the midwives who said that to the rabbi, Tammy says, is now the head midwife. While Rabbi Benny Lau was called in to talk about equal treatment, even he gets why that's hard.
Try to think about yourself. Living in a situation that everyone, your neighborhood, that is from the minorities, are suspecting that maybe he is against you. Think about more than that. Maybe one of your family, you know, was in a situation of terror act. And then try to think about this midwife who come to her work, to hospital, day after sitting Shiva to her husband who killed in the terror act. And then she see the whole family, the Palestinian family, come to have birth. What her feeling is?
Maybe they don't smile, but they do the same job. Thanks God, it's nobody was killed in my family. Yeah. And a lot of the people in Jerusalem, in Israel, they have some of the family who was killed.
We're back with Rivka in the maternity ward.
You try to help women to give birth and you get this so sweet baby, so nice baby, and you don't know what this baby will be. Maybe a terrorist, maybe this baby will kill our kids. I don't understand that everybody in this world is equal, and in Arabic people, in Hebrew people, in Jewish people, the same.
You don't understand that?
No.
But what do you mean?
I think it's our country and Arabic people is a guest here.
To try to get where Rivka's coming from, you have to realize that she grew up in Russia. She wasn't a religious Jew back then, but she was still a Jew.
In Russia, I was a guest.
In 1941, Rivka's family fled from the Nazis. They rebuilt their lives in Russia after the war, but Rivka didn't feel like she belonged there. When she moved to Israel, she finally felt at home. She started covering her hair and praying regularly. She moved to a West Bank settlement. A few years ago, after she took a trip to Poland and saw concentration camps, her attachment to Israel became even stronger.
So I don't understand people that they don't understand that it can happen again.
Rivka compares her family's tragedy to what's happening to Palestinians today.
It's the same for me. This is a country, but somebody take it when the time we wasn't here. So it's the same.
Do you think it's like fair or okay?
This is what we have. These people was born here. Understand it's difficult. They can't go away. But everybody should know this is our country. Jewish people country. Jewish people, and we don't have another place in all world. After what happened to Jewish people, we should to be together and keep each other and take care of each other more than other people outside.
But like, your job is to bring more Palestinian life into Israel.
That's what we have, and we have no choice. What can we do? What can we do?
As a nurse, like, what is your responsibility to this issue?
Just stay human being. Maybe people see us and try to be like us, and then the world will be better.
As the night shift wraps up, Rivka checks in on a Palestinian patient. She seems worried, and Rivka smiles at her. Earlier, I asked how she could be so nice to everyone.
I don't know, really. Maybe because it's nothing happened to me. I hope that the world will be better. And I believe Jewish people must do the best in this world. Maybe we'll change.
3 weeks later, her friend, Daphna Meir, was stabbed to death inside of her home in a West Bank settlement. She was around Rivka's age and a mother to six. Rivka sent me a few pictures of Daphna. She was a nurse, Rivka said. Took care of many Arabs.
When baby born, I say, I hope God bless you and you'll be nice to Jewish. Remember who helped your mother to give birth.
Several months after the story was produced, Mount Scopus midwives told reporter Shana Sheely that segregation is no longer taking place in the maternity ward. This edition of Making Contact was produced by Shana Sheely, with additional audio mixing by Monica Lopez. Advisors were David Cohn, Richard Cosi Hernandez, Dolly Lee, and Cynthia Gorney. Special thanks to Rivka, Tammy, and each woman who shared her story. Tan Feldman, Nahum Begleiter, and the Shani family. Anna Sussman, Danny Zwerdling, Joan Beter, Tim McGurk, the Berkeley Institute for Jewish Law and Israel Studies. Music by Beware of Safety, A New Dawn, Adriana Crickle, Cuddle Formation, Ergo Fizmiz, Mon Plaisir, Kirill Shirikov, Lee Rosevier, and Quiet Music for Tiny Robots. Additional footage and sound by the Spielberg Jewish Film Archive at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Dan Williams, Jeffrey Heller, and Ori Lewis for Reuters. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. RJ Lozada, Marie Che, and Anita Johnson are producers. Quan Booth is our digital content and community engagement manager. I'm Monica Lopez.
Wings thanks Making Contact for sharing this documentary. You can find their program archives at radioproject.org. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to our Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Lee Bana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
KPP Concerts has a stacked lineup of all-ages concerts happening at the Broom Factory through the summer into early fall. On June 27th, check out Housewife, followed by Friday's Child at the Broom Factory on July 11th. Then on August 10th, enjoy music from hip-hop artist Matt Mack, followed later by The Dirty Nil on September 19th. Then on September 26th, it's Petite Belle Ivo and neo-grunge icons The Bridge City Sinners coming to town.